Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, Nostra Aetate, Sunday, marks the 47th anniversary of this landmark church document, and a pilgrimage back in time through early Christian decorative art in the Vatican museums. But first, our correspondent to the Synod on the New Evangelization, Philippa Hitchin, sends us this report on today's events.
It was New York's Cardinal Timothy Dolan who reminded the Synod that Jesus' first words to his disciples were, "Come, follow me," and that his last words were, "Go into all the world and preach the good news to all creation." Those two simple commands, "come" and "go," are really at the heart of all the hotly debated topics that have been taking place both in the Synod Hall and behind the closed doors of the Circoli Minores, or small language groups. From these two commands comes the responsibility of each and every Christian to share the story of our faith and to witness to God's love through our daily lives. Alongside those responsibilities, though, I've also been hearing a new expression of the inalienable right of each person to hear the Christian gospel, as well as the right to full religious freedom and the right to convert to a different religion. Since the Vatican II document Dignitatis Humanae, the teachings of the popes of the past half century have developed the idea of religious freedom as the foundation for all other human rights. Yet it's the experience of many bishops working in Islamic or other countries where the church is a small minority that is calling for a new and bolder rights-based language. It's also been suggested that a commission be set up to represent the church in different parts of the world and to document those places where such rights are being denied. From the Synod Hall, I'm Philippa Hitchin.
Nostra Aetate, that's the Latin term, referring to the Declaration on the Relation of the Church to Non-Christian Religions. The average Catholic or Jewish person probably wouldn't know this document that came out of the Second Vatican Council, but this five-paragraph-long declaration, the shortest issued from Vatican II, was to dramatically change the way the Catholic Church dialogues with people of other faiths, and, in a special way, with the Jewish people. The declaration, promulgated on October 28, 1965, by Pope Paul VI, rejected the idea that Jews were collectively responsible for Jesus' death. Jews, it said, should not be presented as rejected or accursed by God. The declaration also decries all displays of anti-Semitism made at any time by anyone. Well, I was curious to hear what people in the land of Christ's birth know about Nostra Aetate, so on a recent trip to Jerusalem, I brought my questions to Father David Neuhaus, Patriarchal Vicar for Hebrew-speaking Catholics. He's just the right person to ask because he himself comes from a Jewish Israeli family. I began by asking him if Nostra Aetate is taught in Arab Christian or Israeli society in any way.
I would say that most unfortunately, most Jews wouldn't know what we're talking about. They wouldn't understand the language that we are using. But the occasions of the two papal visits, the two most recent papal visits, firstly the visit of Pope John Paul II in the year 2000, and then the visit of Pope Benedict in 2009, were two visits that drew attention to the change that has taken place in the church, so that Jews might not know what Nostra Aetate is, but what they see is the head of the Catholic Church coming with great respect to visit our Jewish brothers and sisters. The visit of both Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI to the chief rabbinate, the prayer at the Western Wall, the visits to Yad Vashem would go a very long way in showing an Israeli public that would have a certain education of suspicion towards the Catholic Church. It would make them realize something has changed here. The tone of these visits, the respect in which, with which the Pope goes to visit the chief rabbis, the president of the State of Israel, discusses with the prime minister. All of these meetings make very present in a very iconographic way, in a very visual way, the changes that we know happened as a result of the Second Vatican Council, as a result of the document of Nostra Aetate. We still have a long way to go, because of centuries on both sides of the divide, the Jewish-Christian divide, centuries of a teaching of contempt for the other. It takes a long time to fully eradicate that. But there is movement. There is movement in that line within the State of Israel.
Nostra Aetate, of course, dates back to the 1960s when the Second Vatican Council took place. Have there ever been study sessions dedicated to that document?
Oh, absolutely. One of the fields in which Christianity is particularly important is, of course, training the hundreds and hundreds of Israelis who work as tour guides. And they are the ones who guide around Christians. But not only there, there has been extensive attention given in universities and other institutes of learning to the developments within the Catholic Church. I have participated in many of these sessions, and there have been many, many sessions devoted to that. Of course, as always happens, this tends to be the monopoly of an educated elite. I'm not sure that if you walked in the street and asked an average Israeli about the most recent developments within the Catholic Church, whether that Israeli might be able to answer. But certainly an educated elite, and also increasingly among Orthodox Jews, is aware that something interesting and important is happening within the Catholic Church. And the testimony to that is the incredible search, a constant search within universities and other institutes of higher learning for Christians who are able to teach about Christianity in Hebrew. Of course, here the church must become more conscious of the need to train Christians to enter into dialogue with Jews and be willing to serve as spokespeople for the church within Jewish, Israeli, Hebrew-speaking society.
One does hear stories, very unfortunate stories, in the Holy Land, in Jerusalem itself, of priests, religious, being spat upon, indicating that a certain type, certain schooling of Judaism really does see Christians as, well, with contempt. Is there anything being done to change that attitude or that perception of, you know, of Christianity?
There have been a number of incidents, particularly within the Old City, and particularly involving more extremist Orthodox Jews in acts of contempt and even attacks, physical attacks on Christians. And there we have allies within the Jewish society who are trying to raise consciousness about how unacceptable this is. I think it is important, though, that we understand that this is not only a teaching of contempt based upon some kind of theological judgment of Christianity, but also the very sad memories of how Christians treated Jews in many places outside of Israel, where Christians were the majority and Jews were a minority. Unfortunately, it's Palestinian Christians who often bear the brunt of this hostility. Palestinian Christians had nothing to do with what went on in Europe. But at the same time, the very sign of a cross can send some Jews off on a rampage. The very sign of the cross brings back memories of great traumas throughout Jewish history. And I think that here, again, what is required is an enormous amount of love, an enormous amount of patience, and an insistence that things change. Things need to change. I go back to the basic point, and that is our Jewish brothers and sisters must take responsibility for the fact that here they are the majority, and therefore they are obligated, as the dominant majority, to make sure that minorities can live in respect, in peace, and continue their lives, their day-to-day lives, as they should.
What efforts has the Latin Patriarchate taken? What steps has it taken to try to engage the Orthodox Jewish community more in the dialogue?
Much progress was made in the time of His Beatitude Michel Sabbah. Michel Sabbah, who was the Latin Patriarch for 21 years, and what is so significant about the time of his patriarchate was it was for the first time that the Church of Jerusalem had a local-born, a Palestinian Arab patriarch. And especially after the year 2000, when the church took up a new pastoral plan, which, very important to state, was the implementation of Vatican II within the life of the local church, a synodal process within the Church of the Holy Land over 5 years, tried to formulate how the teaching of Vatican II can be incarnated within our local circumstances. And after that synodal process, Patriarch Michel Sabbah founded a commission for relations with the Jewish people that met once a month, mostly, and brought into the Patriarchate different representatives of Jewish life in Israel, not only Orthodox, but a very wide representation of Jewish voices in order to listen to them. And Patriarch Sabbah always said the most important job in the beginning is to be able to listen, to start to discover the reality of the other. But then also, slowly, slowly, to present the reality of the Christian Palestinian that is often very much not known by the average Israeli. And so I think that there has been some advance. Patriarch Sabbah also insisted very strongly on the teaching of courses about Judaism in the seminary in Bethlehem University. Again, the problem is the political conflict, the incredibly difficult abyss to bridge, not because of theological positions or positions on truths connected to religion, but because of the very, very sad ongoing conflict, which makes meetings between Palestinian Christians and Israeli Jews very difficult. Through the centuries, Orthodox with a little O, true Christians have been called upon to read and reread the Old Testament because of their awareness that the New Testament is profoundly rooted in the Old. There is no way to understand the New Testament without the Old. The scriptures of Israel are an integral part of who we are as a Christian people. So that the rather superficial judgment that the Old Testament is full of revenge and war and eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, of course, is a kind of selection of texts that are problematic. I think that there are parallel texts in the New Testament that are no less problematic, but ignores the fundamental dynamic of a God who is constantly in search of his beloved children, his sons and daughters, which is the story that Israel bequeaths to Jesus, and through Jesus that becomes our story. I don't at all feel any internal resonance with the description of the Old Testament as a book that talks about a tooth for a tooth, an eye for an eye, vengeance and war. What we are engaged here in, and here in particular in this land, is trying to combat the manipulation of the Old Testament heritage in order to justify injustice and conquest. This is a very, very dangerous and perverted reading of the Old Testament that is rather widespread in fundamentalist Christian circles, not only Protestants, but some Catholic circles as well. Christian Zionism, which is rather different from Jewish Zionism, has its own history and its own logic and is very connected to the history of a fundamentalist interpretation of Scripture that I think is a perverted one, very far from the message of Scripture. And the local church here in Israel and Palestine is particularly challenged by that because sometimes the feeling of local believers is our own holy book is being used against us. That's being used as a title to a land that is also the land of our forefathers, and this book is being used to dispossess us. And so a very important part of my own work is also to teach Old Testament so that it can become a nourishing source of life for Christians, and most important of all, a book through which we can see with much greater detail the person of God and Jesus.
Are you, through your work, trying to engage some of these Christian evangelicals who believe in bringing back the Jews to this part of the world in order to bring about the Second Coming?
We do have some dialogue, particularly with a group in this country who are called Messianic Jews. Messianic Jews are a very, very diverse group of people, and some of those that are more fundamentalistic and evangelical would be profoundly anti-Catholic and so would not be in dialogue with me. But I think that there is an enormous need here to engage all readers of the biblical text, not only Protestant and evangelical Christian Zionists, but also Jews, in order to come back to what is this text fundamentally teaching. Is it fundamentally teaching a lesson about who the land belongs to within the conflict situation, or is there something much more important, much more profound, much more God-centered that is of value in the text? And I think here we have an enormous challenge in front of us in the need to dialogue about the biblical text so that the biblical text is not manipulated and perverted and used as a justification for violence and retribution.
And a warm thanks there to Father David Neuhaus, Patriarchal Vicar for Hebrew-speaking Catholics in the Holy Land. If you've ever visited Rome, you'd know that the city's early Christians, like their pagan counterparts, buried their dead in catacombs along the consular roads going in and out of the city. Some of the most important were the Appian Way, the Salaria, the Flaminia, the Cassia, and the Tiburtina. The catacombs were full of personal objects and Christian symbols, and you can see an important collection of these in a special Vatican exhibit.
As part of their 500th anniversary celebrations for 2006, the Vatican Museums refurbished the Christian Museum, which contains many of the artifacts found in excavations of the catacombs. I took a tour of the museum, which is found in what used to be the Papal Library, but what is now a wing of the Vatican Museums. Starting with the early Christian findings in the Christian Museum, visitors can begin what I'd call a historical and artistic pilgrimage throughout the ages of Christianity. Proceeding down what seems to be like miles of corridor, they can view medieval, Renaissance, and Baroque objects of Christian devotion too. This pilgrimage, which leads all the way to the Sistine Chapel, takes visitors past the Santo Santorum, a collection of highly ornate boxes and caskets that once contained some of the Church's most prized relics from Jesus' Passion, the cross and crown of thorns, and other relics. They have since been returned in new containers to their resting place at the Holy Stairs at the Basilica of St. John Lateran across the Tiber River. My guide on my own tour was decorative arts curator Guido Cornini. I wanted to know if the Christian Museum, in effect, is the first leg of a pilgrimage that culminates in Michelangelo's spectacular Sistine Chapel.
Actually, it's to be found on the way back from the Sistine Chapel, because here, this very part of the Vatican Museums is placed along a corridor which links the Sistine Chapel with the exit, actually. So people unexpectedly find this lots of findings and archaeological, mostly, exhibits when going out of the Sistine Chapel and prepared to cross those who once were the Vatican Library's section. As a matter of fact, this collection was gathered by the Vatican Library at the mid of the 18th century by Pope Benedict XIV, Lambertini, very well known for his promotion of culture in general. He was the one who had the idea of opening a museum, and for the time it was a very modern thinking, focused on early Christian archaeology. That means on the archaeological finds which were found in the catacombs, in the most famous Roman cemeteries developing underground for kilometers and kilometers, and which were the burial place for many generations of Christians in the early centuries of our age.
The array of objects left me spellbound. Exotic fish and sea creatures bursting out of glass lanterns, hand-carved ivory figures and faces, silver dishes designed with the signs of the early Christian faith.
Little gems or glasses or stones of different kinds, engraved stones, I mean, and more, and oil lamps. And all are, in some cases, moving, in some cases, just historically meaningful witnesses of their own period, of a period in which these Christians were not so much different from their contemporary pagan fellows, and in which the only thing which distinguished ones from the others was their strong faith in a different perspective in life and in the hereafter as well. And therefore, it's not unusual to find members of the same family professing different beliefs. And even in the case of a certain Christian faithful, there's some confusion, what we might regard as some sort of theological confusion in their linearity and consistency of expression of faith.
Now, I see a lot of people walking by here, and few of them are stopping to actually look at what is in these beautifully ornate cabinets. After you've seen the Sistine Chapel, maybe this might seem a bit dull to people. What is not dull about it? What should grab their attention?
Well, of course, it's not an exhibition of art in the most traditional sense. Again, being archaeological documents, they should be understood more as a witness to their own times. So we're not dealing with something which is beautiful, which can appeal to people passing so exhausted after they're queuing up before entering the Vatican museums and then inside the galleries themselves and finally until they reach their final aim, which is the Sistine Chapel itself. Once out, I can't believe they are so tired and maybe they are not so willing to stop by and to reflect. But this is it. This was thought, as a matter of fact, as a room which was part of the Vatican Library. So before it came to be musealized, so to speak, this room was accessible from the other part. And in fact, the front of the room is ornate and the architectural setting looks on the northern part of the corridor. Because scholars were supposed to pass from the reading room to the musealized part of the library housing these particular collections. And it was meant as a visit in itself, not something which is nowadays included in these mass touristic tours for people coming from all over the world, which in one day have to secure all Roman highlights, including the Sistine Chapel. It's craftsmanship. It's the work of humble hands working on such everyday objects like oil lamps, for instance. They may be in clay or in bronze or in beautifully ornated glasses, maybe engraved or decorated with golden leaf, or even rings, or even devotional medals to wear upon their own clothes. I mean, all the kind of things you wouldn't expect connected with the world of fine arts, but more on the level of anthropological meaning.
But there certainly are some absolutely extraordinarily beautiful things here.
Yes, also, particularly the golden glasses. We may take a look in the other window. They were the bottom of actual bowls or vases of some sort, which used to be decorated with a golden leaf, which was partially engraved, and with this graffiti technique, you could get figures out of that, or ornamental patterns in general. And in the end, the golden leaf stratum came to be trapped between two layers of glass. They were put together in a furnace of some sort, and the final result was to have these beautiful and luxurious decorations, meant not certainly for the humblest layers of society, but for a richer society.
Explain what we're seeing here. These are the bottoms of goblets or plates, glassware.
Exactly. They were broken purposely when the deceased came to be buried, because this sort of marks were put inside the plaster of the loculum, of the actual burial site.
The catacombs were made up of miles of underground galleries cut out into rows of rectangular niches called loculi, of various dimensions where the bodies of the dead were laid to rest. Decorations such as these gold-leaf glass designs, placed on the outside of a burial chamber, would help relatives locate their deceased family members.
C'è in fisso una statuina con un piccolo amorino. Un amorino, guardate, con una fiaccola rovesciata, era il simbolo della morte, no? La fiaccola che veniva spenta. È un simbolo pagano. Ma guardate, è una cosa che i cristiani...
Curator Umberto Utro literally bubbles over with enthusiasm, talking about how early Christians used much of the same iconography as their pagan counterparts, but proudly displayed their Christian heritage.
Credere, ecco, è la cultura dei primi cristiani, è il loro modo di essere, che piano piano veniva trasformato alla luce della nuova fede.
Utro was talking about beautiful marble reliefs, silver dishes and terracotta oil lamps used in everyday life, but the designs were Christian. Today, he said, you wouldn't be able to find fish and loaves of bread embroidered on a Valentino or a Gucci dress or handbag, but Rome's early Christians wore such emblems with pride. Curator Cordini agrees.
To show somebody's personal beliefs was not something attaining to the private sphere. of personality was something which was made in the public, particularly from the 4th century onwards, when so-called peace of the church, Constantine recognized Christian religion as the official empire religion, and therefore the glory of the altars, so to say, was open to them. Yes, it was possible to use religious motifs, let's say, as decoration patterns.
One of the concepts I found particularly interesting is how Christian belief was interpreted in artwork by early Christians. Rather than cremate the dead, as many Roman pagans did, early Christians looked forward to a reawakening. The catacombs were laid out like sleeping chambers, places of rest on an ongoing journey. In the exhibit, too, visitors will see early crosses bearing the Greek symbols for Alpha and Omega, Christ as the beginning and the end. But in a few cases, you'll see the symbols switched, the Omega before the Alpha, as if to underline the belief that life actually begins after death.
You're underlying the sense of eternity by preposing the Omega rather than the Alpha as the historical beginning of every single individual life.
But not just eternity, but the beginning of life after death.
Yes, in similar senses, in the early Christians speak of the death day as a dies natalis, as you may know, which is the birthday, the real birthday of somebody's to the real life, which is the eternal life which expects us after death. Of course, for a lay approach, this is nonsense. For a Christian approach, this is the difference.
For early Christians, it was a different, concept that life begins after death from the pagan concept.
Of course. Even if they both shared some kind of very physical approach to the idea of burial, because both of them, I mean the two groups, pagans and Christians, would surround the deceased with things which used to be like his personal favorite objects in life, so to say. Typically, talking about a child, toys. We have the number of little dolls, for instance, in ivory or in wood, which were meant as...
As part of this exhibit?
Not here particularly, but they were found and they're exhibited elsewhere, but not particularly here. But for the same reason you find rings, for instance, or golden glasses, or personal objects which, again, were put in the plaster of the burials to make them recognizable.
And a very warm thanks there to my guide on that tour of the Christian Museum, Guido Cornini, curator for the Decorative Arts Department of the Vatican Museums. And now this announcement. As of next week, the feature program will no longer be available on these frequencies in this half-hour format. Our weekend service will not be affected. However, you can find all of our news and interviews on our website. That's simply rv.va. And you can click on the English World icon. Please do get in touch with us to let us know what you think of these changes and how we can continue to provide the best service to all of our listeners. We look forward to hearing from you on our email address, that's english@vatiradio.va, or on our mailing address, that's Vatican Radio's English Service, Piazza Pia 3, 00120, Vatican City. You've been listening to Vatican Radio's feature program. I'm Tracy McClure. Goodbye. Laudator Jesus Christus.